Good afternoon, everyone, and thanks for coming along. This is a bit of a fun talk. The idea is to convince you to all start your own junk code directory where you put little snippets of odds and ends of code. And so the sort of made-up quote there is the best example code is your own code, because it's so much easier to understand your own bits of rotten code from the past than other people's. So what is junk code? Junk code is just little snippets of code that you might write to test a hypothesis, to solve some trivial problem, to do something really minor. And most programmers, when they have these little snippets of code, they throw them away, or they just leave them lying in some random directory, the working directory they happen to be in, and when they move to another machine, or they move to, you know, for whatever reason, that code is lost. And I started realizing that junk code was valuable back in about 1993. That's when I started my junk code directory. And now when I do these little snippets of code, I put them in there. So I work on the little snippets of code in there, and sometimes I even commit them into CVS and make them available to the world. Sometimes I don't. About half or a third or so of the code in my junk code directory is in CVS and publicly available. So I think that keeping a junk code directory is an important part of becoming a better programmer. It's important because, at least for me, my memory is very fallible. I forget how to do things. I forget how to use those weird system calls, those weird F controls, whatever, that you might have known how to use 5 or 6 years ago, then you need to use them at some stage later. Now, you can Google for them. When you Google for them, you tend to end up finding an application that has been, it's like version 4 of the application or whatever, and it's using it, but it's using it in a sophisticated, complex way that fits in with a whole infrastructure. And that can be hard. It can be hard to see from that example exactly how you use it. Whereas when you first learnt about that particular function or that particular thing, you may well have written yourself a little sample program to test the idea, to make sure you understood. And that is, I find, the most valuable piece of code to keep. So when I go grepping around in my junk code directory for these functions that I've forgotten how to use later, I can find example code. It reminds me of my previous research, or whatever if you call it that, you know, reading the man page, if there is one. It reminds me of that previous time when I learned how to do that. And I find it's extremely valuable. It's also, it can help you build good applications because you're needing to, you're writing some application and you need to be able, for a good example is, you want to be able to mmap a file. You want to be able to take a file name and return a void star or a char star pointing to that file with a size. Something that, how many of you have done that, written a function that does that? You know, a fair number of you. If you're a system programmer, you've done that. How many have done it more than once? Probably about the same number of people. Right, so why didn't you keep that little snippet of code? You know, map underscore file takes a, you know, const char star file name. I got const religion a year or two ago, so I put the consts in there now. And it takes, you know, size t star size, whatever. And it's a little pattern. And you can reproduce it easily enough, but you've just wasted a few minutes, you know, re-looking up the man page for mmap. Remembering that you need to do the following to make it portable because, you know, map underscore file mightn't exist on some systems. You've got to put the fn def or whatever. So, yeah, it's just really handy having those bits and pieces. So the other part of this talk is to give you a bit of a tour and show you some of the stuff that has ended up in my junk code directory over the years, over 11 years of gathering stuff. And there's all sorts of odds and sods of stuff in there. And so hopefully you'll get the idea of the sort of thing I'm talking about. So here is one of the earliest bits of junk code. It was actually, I think, I started in about February 93. I think this example is from like March 93. And that's the whole file. That's all that's there. It's called sleeptest.c, sleeptst.c, because we hate vowels or something. I don't know. So can you guess what it does? If you're a C programmer, stare at it for a few seconds, you can probably guess what it does. Right, so it's going to do something 10 times, it's going to do a couple of get times a day and some use sleeps. The core of it is you sleep one times I, so it's sleeping for like 1, 2, 3, 4, 10 microseconds. Now, by itself, it's completely, it's showing a diff. It actually is printing out a diff. Isn't that nice? So it's printing out the time difference between these U sleeps. And these days, I might use another tool to do it, but it was handy. You run it a few times, and you can see the jitter that you get. So why don't I run that and show you the sort of thing that I tend to do with these types of junk code. And so if we watch sleep test and see what it's doing. Watch, by the way, is a really handy command that a lot of even quite experienced Unix people don't seem to know about. It just runs a thing again and again and displays its output continuously. You can see it updating, and you can see the number of microseconds between runs. It's quite interesting that the zero U sleep tends to be around 5,000 microseconds, and the ones above that are all consistently around 20. And if you understand something about the Linux kernel scheduler that I don't really pretend to do, then you could possibly understand that. But it was useful. I was experimenting, playing. It's the sort of thing where, well, I wonder, you know, whether U-sleep really does do that. And then, of course, you fiddle with the code a little bit, and you shove in the set shed call to make it real time, right? And then, of course, you find you get quite different results, okay? Because you actually get much more accurate microsleeps when you're in a real-time scheduling for the process. So it's handy to have, you know, that sort of thing, to be able to play with that. So that's the sort of thing I mean by junk code. Little experiments. Sometimes they grow a bit more. Okay, so why would you want to do it? You might be testing how a library function works. You're just not sure. In that case, I was testing how U-sleep works. Right? What does it actually do? Does it really do 7 microseconds? And no, it doesn't. Okay, easy enough to find out. Any systems programmer could have told you it doesn't, but it's nice to confirm things for yourself. It might be testing your understanding of a language feature. So I've got all sorts of things where I write a little test program because I'm wondering, should we start using this particular language feature in Samba? And I need to know, how portable is it? Now, I could look at various standards and things, or I could write a little tiny test program, then blast it out to 20 different architectures around the place, and just see, you know, does it work on all of those? Which ones does it work on? Which ones doesn't? Does it only work on Debian Linux, or does it actually work on the other half of the computers in the world? You might see if you can try and trigger a bug. So you might think that there might be a bug somewhere, a race condition or something. You might write a little test program to see if you can trigger that. You might be exploring an idea for a larger program. So you might have some idea for the next killer app and just want to play around a little bit, explore the idea. I'm sure you've all done this sort of thing if you're an application developer or a systems programmer. Or possibly you're just buggering around trying to avoid real work and making sure there's actually some source code on your screen. Anyway, so the reason you keep it is people tend to forget stuff. I find I forget how to do things in systems programming all the time. And so by keeping it in a directory and combining that with grep, marvelous way of reminding yourself how to do things. And then I also find, so I go and grep around. I also find that looking at my own code reminds me faster of how to do something than looking at someone else's. Okay, it's also like a toolbox. Sometimes I might be in a meeting at, you know, at my work and people discussing, oh, we need to do this, we need to test. One that's come up recently is somebody was chatting around the office about testing disk speed. You want to see how fast can you read from disks, right? Now, it just so happens that I needed to do that a couple of jobs ago. And so I had a little tiny utility called readFiles that does that. It takes a bunch of file names and loops through them and displays you the throughput you're getting on each file. So you can use it on devices and files and stuff. It's a trivial thing to write, but being able to immediately pull it out and run it just saves you that time. And you've already debugged it. You already know that it doesn't do something completely insane, or maybe it does, but okay, wasn't so noticeable, whatever. It's much better. It's a good way to impress the boss to say, you know, instead of saying, I once wrote a program that does something like that, and they say, ho-hum, you say, here is a program that does that, and then you're all set. So there you go. Impress the boss. So anyway, leaving that aside for a moment, what I thought I'd do now is give you a bit of a tour of some of the things in my junk code directory. And I hope that there is something in here for everyone. The idea is that everyone in the audience goes away and at least one of these things says, yes, I need that on my system. At least I hope so. We'll see. So these are some I've picked out. I've got a little over 400 programs in my junk code directory. There's about 150, 200 odd or something actually in CVS publicly available. Why don't I always make them publicly available? Well, I'm lazy. I forget to do the CVS add. I forget to do the CVS commit, whatever. I added another 40 during the last talk half an hour or so ago. So there's some more there now. So if you think you've looked through my junk code directory, there's some more stuff to look at now. So I've picked out a few of them, ones that I thought would hopefully give something for everyone. So the first one is SegV handler. And this one is small enough that I can show the whole source code on the screen. Right, this is the whole of SegV handler. And personally, I think this should be in every distribution. This should be in every Linux distribution out there, but probably without the bugs. Can you see the bugs? No, lack of error checking, all that sort of thing. That's a characteristic of my junk code directory. Because it's junk code. It's stuff that isn't documented. It's stuff that I haven't, you know, I'm not worried too much if there's bugs. It's the sort of stuff where it can take, you know, 4 years for somebody to actually, when they send me a patch to it, to me to actually add it. Is Andrew Towns here, by the way? Yep. I committed your goats fix a few minutes ago. Thank you. That was an interesting one. The goats.c was a piece of junk code. We were arguing in the office about the solution to the goats conundrum. Do you all know the goats conundrum? We have, like, behind three doors, two of the doors has a goat behind it, one of the doors has a pot of gold, and what's the strategy if the game show host says, gives you a, you make one guess, and if you get it wrong, then he gives you a hint or something. I've forgotten. Anyway, there's this conundrum, okay, and the solution is that you ignore, or they change, you do change. Anyway, so this goat solves that, and I had a bug in it. And it absolutely floored me when somebody actually sent me a patch to my goat.c. So take a bow, Andrew. And of course, it took me a couple of years or whatever it was to actually commit the fix. I was looking through my mail for junk code things and noticed your mail. Right, so what does SegV handler do? Okay. See, only thing I missed out, by the way, is a couple of include lines up the top that you need. I thought that being the programmers you are, you won't need the couple of include lines. You can do without them. Apart from that, what it does is this installs a system-wide segmentation fault handler. Now, why we needed this, I was working for a NAS company that wrote really unreliable software, and I was one of their programmers. And in particular, their GUI systems, which I didn't write, used to fall over all the time. There was made of lots and lots of little CGI programs all over the place. And tracking down the bugs, launching a debugger on a CGI is a real pain. So instead, it's much easier. I've got this little LD preload that is installed via etc.ld.so.preload. And that lists a shared library which gets loaded into every program on the system. So every program on the system gets a default segmentation fault handler. Okay, that's a error handler for those of you who aren't systems programmers. It means that any program on the system, if it hasn't installed its own segmentation fault handler, which overrides this, will get this default one, and when you get a segmentation fault, it launches GDB on itself, rather introspective, and produces you a full backtrace in /tmp, BT full, so all of the local variables all the way up the stack. So I'll give you a demo of this. So I've got a buggy program here, which I had to make specially, of course. So here's SegV handler. So I've got this etc.ld.so.preload, which just lists, say, SegV handler.so, right? That means every program gets this. And I've got a little testprog.c, and my God, there's a bug in it. It dies when you try and run it. Okay, because it casts 3 as a pointer and then dereferences it. Okay, so if I run that thing, then it dies, fine, but segmentation fault, but in /tmp, I end up with segv testprog dot whatever, and it gives you this full backtrace, you know, out of GDB, which is really handy. So when you then are you putting this on some sort of appliance or whatever, or your, you know, local box, and some random program dies, you have a chance of, and it should of course go in, you know, var seg v or something like that. Sorry, question? That's because it's got a bug. Now, what it should be doing is, it should be aborting. It should call abort at the end that it didn't bother, and yeah, one line fix, yeah. I've noticed that too, it's never worried me. Okay, so, a characteristic of this stuff is that it's buggy, and so whoever, if somebody wants to package this up, it'd be a great thing to package up without the bugs. Okay, so segv handler, useful program. Mail runner. Mail runner is a classic bit of junk code, sort of knocked together when I was using a really low bandwidth link somewhere and I needed to send and receive email. It's email send and receive over rsync over SSH with a few bells and whistles. And it's grown over time. This originally was just a short bash script. It's now a slightly longer bash script. How many people here use Mail Runner for their daily email? A couple of people? Three? Three? I see, for a while you can get serial numbers below 10, right? And I think there's now more than 10 users in the world. So, but probably serial numbers below 100 are still available. Yeah, it's self-assigned. Anyway, so Mail Runner is a really handy little program. So if I'm on the network here, hang on, I've got to get myself back on the network here. So you can all stare at something for a little while I bring up the wireless. Then I run Mail Runner. Okay, so I'm up, Mail Runner. And it goes and fetches all my mail from samba.org and shoves it through procmail locally. Then any local mail that's due to be sent, it sends back over rsync SSH. And so there it is, and there's probably some spam in there, of course. Right, so there it is. It can also pull mail from multiple sources and all sorts of things. It's a really neat little mail system, and the whole thing is like a couple hundred lines of bash, of shell. So you can think of it as a framework which you can then enhance later and add things to. It does have help though. Okay, does partial transfers as well, that's useful. Next one, this I believe, at least no one has contradicted me on this front, I believe is the smallest program to ever get packaged in Debian. And it's really handy, iPrint. It's known as iPrint in Debian. I originally called it just i.c. But apparently you're not allowed to have one character package names, which I think should be fixed. That's terrible. Anyway, so what does iPrint do? Well, I use it a lot. Whenever I've often, you know, I'm doing Samba work or rsync whatever, I've got bunches of integers all over the place. And what's that integer? Well, maybe it's interesting if it's in octal, or maybe it's interesting in binary, or maybe it's an interesting pattern if it's in hex. Right, so you want to sort of convert it to all these different formats and think, aha! It's a nice pattern in octal. I'll take that one home. So you sort of want to, you know, print out a bunch of numbers in different formats. So what you do is, you know, you've got some number and you just type it like that, and it tells me I've got new mail as well. So there you go. And iPrint doesn't do mail. So you can also print multiple numbers like that. Now notice that the octal 08, of course, is an illegal octal number. So print out multiple numbers. One interesting thing about this program is that it supports command line help. So you can see the complete source code for it up there. So that is all of the source code except for the include lines at the top. And notice there's no get opt or checking for help, but it does support I minus minus help. Even though it doesn't have any code for it, which I think is really neat. So if you run I minus minus help, that explains. It's obvious to any programmer what that does. So really useful. Somebody recently sent a patch for this one too. There's actually a patch in Debian, and it doubles the length of the code. It adds support for, what does it add support for? Stephen here, I don't know, is who? Oh yeah, there was a bug with handling of 2 to the 32 minus 1 for some reason, so you just have to know not to try and print that. Anyway, so what it's showing you is like decimal, octal, hex, binary, and character if possible, which is really handy. Okay, so that's iPrint. Useful tool, everyone should have it on their system. It's already been packaged though. All right, so app get install iPrint, everyone. Okay, so T-Server. T-Server is a tiny embedded web server. Now, this was written one Christmas when I was trying to avoid something. Christmas, probably. It's a tiny embedded web server. Now, who here has written a tiny embedded web server? Half the room, probably. Yeah, everyone loves writing. The HTTP protocol is great that way. You know, one can be do this impressive thing of writing a whole web server in, you know, three characters in Perl or something. I don't know. So this one's written in C, but it's had a couple of unusual features. It makes a very small binary. The binary ends up being about 15K. It's got server-side scripting. Now, the reason for this is I was working for a NAS vendor. I've worked for several NAS vendors. They've all gone bust. So I was working for this NAS vendor, and they had a ROM image which had like the initial boot image, and it was a very limited size ROM, and they wanted the complete installation system. So they wanted you to be able to pull all the disks out of the thing and then put in totally fresh disks and boot, and a web server would come up out of ROM, and then you could completely install the software, you know, from that. The problem is we had a limited size ROM. We had to fit everything in there. And we couldn't fit, you know, Apache, PHP, those sorts of things. We needed a tiny web server. But we also wanted to be able to program the CGI on this quite easily. And to do that, I wanted to be able to have server-side scripting, which is, you know, server-side scripting, the sort of thing you do with like mod Perl and PHP and all those sort of things. And so I realized that the startup scripts, we already had Bash, which was, it's just enormous, right? And it was already there consuming half of our ROM. And so we might as well take advantage of that. So this is a server-side scripting language for Bash junkies. Yep. No, it's not particularly specific. You could use a different shell. You could use a smaller one. And it's Bash has some nice programming features. So there are some reasons why Bash is cute. And most, if it's a Linux system, it usually has Bash sitting there. Although you're right, some of the systems might have Ash or something like that. And so here's an example. I'll show you the actual code first. Where is it? Yeah. So here's a lump of HTML. Yep. Okay. So here's a bunch of HTML. It just looks like normal HTML, except up the top, it's got the equivalent of server-side includes, right, where it said include header of HTML up the top. Okay, you can see anything with just curly braces like that just means include it. Then there's a bunch of HTML as per usual. The underlining is from Emacs. That's not part of the thing. Then you can see here like a little printenv. So there you go. You've just dumped out a printenv. There you're doing an LSPCI. There you're looking at proc version. There you're going and doing a little loop over stuff in proc IDE. Network device, etc. So for getting at system stuff where you're launching external commands, it's really handy. And so there's the output of that. This was from the Quantum Snap server, and you can see the environment, you can see the PCI devices, all that sort of stuff. And you can do, you know, a full decent web server, web interface this way. You can probably even make it look pretty if you tried a bit. Okay, so that's T-Server. Hopefully useful for somebody, although I know there are squillions of little embeddable web servers out there because everyone's written one. Well, I've written one too. So there. Okay. So 3D Tic Tac Toe, this actually started after a plane flight back from Japan with my graduate supervisor, and we were discussing whether it was possible to solve the 4x4x4 tic-tac-toe problem, right? Three-dimensional tic-tac-toe problem, the sort of thing you discuss with, you know, supervisors on planes. Anyway, so I'd wanted to learn a bit about OpenGL and about game programming. I'd never done anything like that. So I thought I'd write myself a little n by n tic-tac-toe program and then make it do OpenGL stuff so I can learn a bit about it. And this program is reused the code from this, snippets of code from this, so many times in lots of different applications. Whenever I need to do something in OpenGL, I've got a really simple little program that does all the sorts of things that, you know, OpenGL, well, simple OpenGL that I wanted to write, might do. Let's see. Okay, let's go there. So here it's running. And you can, you know, spin stuff around, so it's got a virtual trackball in there. You can play pieces. It's got a computer opponent using alpha, beta search and all sorts of stuff. You can do things like ask it to suggest a move, get it to play against itself in a demo mode. And, of course, really essential things like changing the piece type to, say, for example, a teapot. Absolutely essential, that. Teapot being a base type in OpenGL is just brilliant. You know, it's just, I love it. You know, we got spears and we got toruses and we got teapots. Yeah, excellent. So anyway, it was a great little program, and you'll probably recognize it, the style of OpenGL stuff I've done there is, of course, what I ended up using in Nightcap. Nightcap's my chess program. And so that was another bit of procrastination. Yeah, it didn't actually start off in junk code, but it was derived from junk code. So it was derived from my the 3D tic-tac-toe code. You can see the similarity, you know, in style of interface and things, but it plays a fairly decent game of chess. Actually, the tic-tac-toe plays quite a good game of tic-tac-toe. So if anyone does want a game of 4x4x4 or n by n by n, you can, you know, change the dimensions all you like, It's quite a good game, quite fun. Somebody should package it. There you go. You can't turn a king into a teapot. No. There is a story about crocodiles and things, but anyway. Okay. So GZ Extract is the next little one that I thought I'd show you, and this is my most recent piece of junk code. Wrote this last week. It was Andrew Bartlett's fault, in fact. He'd noticed a NAS vendor, not one that I'd sent bust, but another one that actually survived. And there was this NAS vendor that had dubious compliance with the GBL, the GPL. And so we downloaded their firmware and we thought, well, there's probably like an initRD and various things in this firmware. How do we get it out? And Andrew asked me, how do you extract gzipped files from a big lump? You have this file, which is just, you know, file just calls it data, right? It's a 10 megabyte file or whatever it is. And there's things in it that you want to get out, like kernel versions and initRDs, etc. How do you get it out? Well, it's easy, you know. I'm sure, how many of you here can immediately think how you'd write a program to do that? Sure, lots of you can. You know, look for the gzip header and then just dump all the rest of the file from there. And yeah, so it's relatively easy. It's not a big program to write, but it's handy to have it around. And there's a few little tweaks you can do to it. I fixed a bug in it today, actually, so it handles more different types of compression and that sort of thing in its finding of gzip files. It's very handy, so I can show you that. Where's my little demo window? And so where have I got something? If I show you that, then I've got a it's in the directory named after the vendor, and I probably shouldn't do that. Okay, you just run gz extract on like a file, and it pulls out all of the gz files and puts them into the directory, finding them in there, which is a very handy little tool if you ever have files containing bits of gzip files. I suppose you could use it for recovery if you wanted to, recovering stuff out of tarballs, something like that. There might be other uses for it. Anyway, nice little tool, the sort of thing that you want to have in your junk code. Yeah, it runs quite fast. It's because it's just, all it does is calls mapfile, right? Remember I mentioned mapfile, everyone rewrites mapfile. Well, I just pulled mapfile out of some random bit of junk code and there's the front of the program. And then I already had a little thing that does a search, you know, mem type stuff. And so I pulled that together so that it's sort of like almost object oriented, you know? Piece of this and a piece of that and add a main at the bottom and you're done. So it's sort of piecing together little bits of junk code and you end up with a useful utility. Okay, so Genstruct. Genstruct is one that I could spend a whole talk on. It started off because I inherited the maintainership of this application, which I've now called Lasker. Lasker is an internet chess server. Any of you use like the free internet chess servers? Yeah, a few of you use those where you can connect to, like, to this chess server and play against a whole lot of other people with nothing better to do. That sort of thing. So it's really fun. There's a whole lot of popular chess servers, and there's been a great long history about open source and chess servers and whether the code should be available and that sort of thing. Anyway, there is a branch of one of the earlier versions of the chess server, which I'm now the maintainer for, and that's called Lasker. And so most of the code of this chess server was dealing with saving and loading complex C structures to and from files. Okay, you've got some really complex structure, a player structure with linked lists of attributes which contain linked lists of games and all this sort of stuff, saving and loading that, and of course over the years, this is like a 10 or 15 year old program, a dozen different ways of saving it had been, you know, invented and then with different version numbers of headers of files, and most of the code ended up doing this. And when I started reading through the code, I immediately thought, God, I wish I had Data Dumper. Any of you Perl hackers here? Yep. How many of you have used Data Dumper? Yeah. It's a brilliant little library module in Perl where you just take an arbitrary, you know, Perl data structure, and it gives you back this great big string, right, which represents all the complexes of the data structure. So you can say, put this data structure in that file. Then you start the program late, and you say, give me that. There's a file. Give me all that data structure back. Okay. It's wonderful in Perl. Well, Genstruct is the C equivalent of that. Allows you to do the same thing, but for C, which is really handy. And it has been done by other people in the past with things like, you know, dwarf symbols and stuff. Met somebody here at the conference who'd been doing that. Werner. So this is more portable. What it does, it uses a Perl script to pre-process the C headers into a C table. The runtime is all in C. There's no dependence on Perl at runtime. And at runtime, you can marshal, unmarshal arbitrarily complex C structures. And then it also uses a human-readable marshalling format. It's a very robust marshalling format. You can add and delete elements from structures and it will cope with loading that structure back from disk in the obvious way, even though the shape of the structure, even the order of the elements, whatever, has changed. So it forms the basis for the new version of the Lasker chess server, and it's also used in Samba version 3, solving the problem of versioning of the records in our database files. There is some of them. And Simo Sorsa from Italy has been particularly a champion of this within Samba, and it's been very handy for not having to version stuff. But I'll show you a little bit of a trick, given I've probably got enough time. Got a few minutes? A bit of a trick with this. So what I'll do is I'll connect to my chess server, and I'll just put up a small board. So I'll connect. I've got a chess server sitting in Canberra. And let's see. Okay, and it's probably stuck the board off the screen there, but who cares? Okay, so you can see who's logged in. A whole lot of nightcaps and other people. There's nobody serious playing. I did this for the local, this is a chess server for the local primary school. Now, the interesting thing about this chess server and using a GenStruct, when you have something like GenStruct, that gives you the ability to upgrade C code on the fly. So a chess server, you want it to stay running for days and days, weeks, months on end, but at the same time, you want to fix bugs. So you want to be able to, while people are actively playing games, got lots of open sockets, etc., then you want to be able to go in and fix bugs in that code while the server's running. And usually this is only available in ultra expensive, you know, environments or in, you know, languages that one needs to actually think about other than C. I don't know. So Lasker source. So what I'll do is I'll change something in here. Command list, that'll do. So if I type help here, well, okay, help. Okay. And if I'll just type a random command. You see sort of command not found. Okay, so let's find out where it says command not found in this code. And we'll change it to capital C, command not found. All right? And so if I rebuild this, so I'm rebuilding a whole bunch of C code. And meanwhile, see where there's nothing up my sleeve? People are actually playing games and stuff here. Is there any games going on? Oh, there's one. The lecture bot is currently giving a lecture. Right, so I'll install this. Okay, and then while people are playing games, I can tell it to reload all of the C code in this, and now when I do a wrong command, it's now fixed it. So we've altered the C code on the fly, right? And you can, in fact, originally the Lasker code was all based on static buffers, with buffer overflows everywhere, and it was all fixed size buffers with no error, no bounds checking and that sort of thing. I converted it from that to all dynamic allocation and linked lists without restarting the server. People kept playing while this was going on. And the reason it's possible is that the whole program is a great big shared library with a tiny, tiny C stub that DL opens that shared library, and then an instrumented version of malloc that knows how to free all memory. And so when you reload, what you're actually doing is you're taking all the data structures in the entire program, which is quite a large set of data structures, and you're saying to GenStruct, dump into a file. You have all your data structures in a file. And then what you do is you DL close that shared library, DL open it again, reload all your data structures back from that file, and continue. And that all happens in just a fraction of a second. So it makes for long-lived, robust programs in C. No, I don't do it. It crashes? this has been up for a long time. Actually, the machine, I lost a hard disk in the machine, so its uptime isn't so great. But so it's currently been up for, you know, you can see a little while. It's been up since January the 5th, just because that's when I last lost a hard disk in it. But it stays up for a very long period of time. It's actually quite robust. So anyway, you might like to have a look at GenStruct. And no documentation, but I assure you it's a useful little program. Okay, so TPH disk. This is another one. A lot of laptops in the room. Some of you may have followed IBM's advice. Never a good idea. IBM's advice, if you've got like an IBM ThinkPad and you want to put a hibernation partition in it, is you get this DOS boot floppy, right? And to me, the idea of having to go to a DOS boot floppy to actually set up a hibernation file, a hibernation partition, is just yuck. Now, there is LPHDisk, a Linux PHDisk, that allows you to do this, but only for hibernation partitions, not for hibernation files. So TPHDisk is a much, much simpler program, vastly simpler and much safer than LPHDisk, that handles both partitions and files, and it's got built-in help. There you go. What else could you want? So if you want to set up hibernation on your laptop, you want to grab TPHDisk from Junk Code, and probably this should be packaged as well. It would be a great idea if somebody did that, because it's a really useful program. Okay, so graduates. Sometimes bits of junk code escape out to the real world, or what usually happens is when they grow beyond the bounds of junk code, i.e. somebody actually asks for some documentation or something like that, then what usually happens is I move them in different era of CVS, you know, just into home CVS instead of home CVS junk code, and I basically at that point I create a real project surrounding it. So there's a number of bits of code that have happened before that you might recognize. TDB is the trivial database used in Samba and PPP and a bunch of other applications. DBench is quite a useful benchmarking emulation of the Ziff Davis NetBench. Ccache, the compiler cache, that was originally just a junk code project that escaped. Piddle, which is an IDL compiler and code generator being used for Samba 4. And RZip, which is a compression program that used to have the reputation of being the slowest compression program available, but as of a couple of months ago, Rusty and I came up with a way of making it fast. And so RZip is going to be on a site near you soon, just about to be released, we swear. So there's lots more. So there's 400 odd or something like that programs. I think I've released a couple hundred of them. Go and have a look, sort of something for everyone. But the real thing I'd like you to take away from this talk is that you should start your own. If you don't have a directory where you stick your odds and sods of code for posterity, for whatever reason that you want to use, do. Start keeping it. It's really worthwhile. You won't regret it. It's a really valuable resource. You'll find it's a fantastic resource as a programmer to have little snippets of your own code going back many, many years. Thanks very much. Sure, whatever. Yeah, the question was whether there's any code that's not suitable for public release, so I can't release it. Yeah, that's why I don't just go CVS add star.c or star.pl or whatever and release. Because when I'm creating bits of junk code for my own use, I might sometimes cut and paste somebody else's bit of code in there, and I've got to make sure that I can do that and release it, right? So I've got to actually sit and think about each program to make sure it really is mine, that I can release it. That's because there might be some library function or whatever that I've seen elsewhere and I was playing around with. Sometimes as well, there might be programs that do things that might be needed for... There can be many reasons. I won't go into all of them. But there can be many reasons why one doesn't release stuff. But not releasing it to the world doesn't mean you shouldn't keep it yourself. Because the main point of it, you know, releasing it to the world is something nice. And it'd be great if all of you actually made a public junk code directory. But if you don't have a public CVS server or whatever handy, don't let that stop you keeping it yourself locally and treating it as valuable. That's the thing. You have to treasure it, back it up, you know, treat it as valuable stuff. Yep. Well, I've always made sure that I get, when I sign up, permission to work on pre-existing projects. Junk code is a pre-existing project, and that I get my own copyright. But you have to be a little bit careful about that. I just talk to your managers, and the thing is, it's junk code. They really probably don't care. And a lot of it, of course, is derived from earlier junk code that was GPL'd. So you know, has to be GPL'd anyway. Yep. Oh, yep. You can't get through to that. FTP's... there is a problem in this room. You have to use rate fixed and rate 2 megabit or 1 megabit. You may find that wireless... I found I needed to do that, otherwise I didn't get a reliable enough connection. You forced the rate down. Yeah. Yeah. Yep. Sorry, I'm not quite sure what you mean. Well, you've always got to think about portability, and that's a lot of the programs I've got in there are to do with portability. So if I show you an example, a program I use a lot would be sizeof, sizeof.c, right? You can see what it does, okay? It just prints the size of a bunch of types, and there you go. So I run that on a bunch of different systems. When I get to a new system, I tend to run this. I tend to also run a few other programs. I've got speed.c, right? Which, when I get a new machine, I tend to always run it, and it shows me, you know, the speed of various things, how long it takes to memcopy 1 kilobyte blocks, 100 kilobyte blocks, 1 megabyte blocks, 10 megabyte blocks, integers, doubles, etc. So it sort of gives me an idea for the architecture, what it's basically capable of, that machine. So there's all sorts of little tools that I've got sitting on my system. SEM speed is another one. It measures semaphore speed, that type of thing. And these little tools, it's really handy to be able to have a whole battery of them that you can, you know, try on a new machine when you get a login on it, just to see what the rough parameters of the machine are for what strategies you might use for tuning whatever application it is you're trying to write for that machine. Giving one? When am I planning to send IBM broke? Next question. Yep. Thanks.